to 99.1 WQRT LP, and welcome to Radio Free Book Club for July 2023. I'm Ken Honeywell. I'm a writer and reader from Indianapolis, and today we are talking about an eco-thriller, the latest novel from Eleanor Catton, entitled Burnham Wood. Catton's previous novel, The Luminaries, won the Man Booker Prize in 2013. It had the distinction of being the longest winner of that prize. It weighed in at over 800 pages. Thank goodness for all of us. Burnham Wood was only about half of that. It's set in and around a fictional national park on New Zealand's South Island, where a sort of radical gardening collective has made a deal with an American billionaire who's allowing them to squat on a big tract of land that he's in the process of buying, ostensibly to build a bolt hole to protect himself, but actually to surreptitiously mine the park for rare elements that will make him the wealthiest person in the history of the world.
Right.
Those are some big time evil villain stakes there.
Yeah.
But this is not the story of the plucky environmental do-gooders against the bad guy. It's a little bit more complicated than that. But fortunately, we have an outstanding panel of club members to help break it all down, and I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves. Hello, Dan.
Hi, I'm Dan Barden. I'm a college professor and a novelist and a flaneur.
A flaneur. Wow.
Since you moved downtown, you are now a flaneur.
Awesome.
Walk lobsters on a leash.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Is that enough?
Yeah, that's plenty. Yeah, welcome, Dan. Hello, Susan.
Hello, Ken. I'm Susan Neville, and I'm a writer and also reader. I like that as an introduction. And former professor. I retired. And I like knowing that we are members of a book club.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much. And Jen, you're our MVP for today, filling in at the last minute for the vacationing Steve Woods.
So,
And two shows in a row. Yeah, please introduce yourself.
I am Jen Bingham. I'm not a college professor, so I represent the common man in this discussion. And I'm a writer and reader from Indianapolis.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, Jen. And before we get started, a warning, we are definitely going to spoil Burnham Wood. You definitely don't want to know the ending of this book if you plan on reading it. So this would be a good time to stop listening if you don't want to hear the spoilers. Fortunately, you can read the book and come back and listen, because you can find this and all the episodes of Radio Free Book Club on Mixcloud, Spotify, Apple, just about anywhere you stream podcasts. So if you're going to leave, we hope you'll come back. And if you're staying, let's get to it. So I guess, first of all, who is familiar with Eleanor Catton? Did anyone read The Luminaries?
No.
Anyone? Susan?
Nope. Nope, I have it on my Kindle, but never read it.
I'm the only one who's
you
read The Luminaries.
You are the only one.
So I can ask you questions.
Yeah, awesome. You can't really ask me any questions because it was like 10 years ago.
Okay.
I quite enjoyed it, I remember. It had a lot of characters. Like, it had like a dozen like viewpoint characters, I think. Mm-hmm. Set in New Zealand in the 1860s, I think, during like a gold rush, and there was crime and murder and mystery, and I don't remember it all, but I remember enjoying it quite a bit. So I was looking forward to this book just because I enjoyed her last book.
Was it? Well, I'll get into that stuff later. I have questions, but I'll ask them later.
Yeah, I wondered if you enjoyed this one as much as that, but maybe it's too early to ask that.
Let's just say it's too early to ask that. So anyone want to add anything to my quick little summary of the book? So what did we think? What did we think about the book in general? What worked for you? Didn't work for you?
I was just listening to a podcast on the way over here, and it was Ezra Klein's podcast, and he had this guy on there, and at the end of it, Ezra always asks, name three books, and this guy who was so, I guess loquacious is the word, said, I'm not going to mention this book, and I'm not going to mention this book. So he found a way to mention like seven books without, you know.
That's what I was going to do at the end of this. Well,
and it's funny with this because it's like I feel like I want to. I'm hesitant to to dive in because I have so many things that I almost don't want to say. You know what I mean? I want to see what everyone else makes out of the book, which is a tremendously accomplished book that I have a lot of problems with. Yeah. Like I don't want it ever to get back to Eleanor that I had problems with the book, right? But I had lots of problems with the book.
Yeah. You know interesting. What
I mean? Because she's clearly just a brilliant, brilliant writer, you know? So
okay.
I just finished reading Demon Copperfield in the middle of reading this once and then twice. And I was, and that's one of the books I would recommend, but I was thinking how interesting it is that there are all these books that are really kind of page-turner novels that are also kind of arguments. You know, Demon Copperfield, every chapter you think, oh, this is an argument against this or that kind of ideological thing that we're all thinking or hearing now. And I felt that way about Burnham Wood, too. There were so many arguments in it about, I mean, actual literal arguments between people about ideas. And so I kind of loved that in the first part of the book. I really loved that they're dealing with important economic issues and what are billionaires for and how much are we all complicit in any problems with capitalism. And in that sense, it reminded me a little bit of some of Doris Lessing's novels, like particularly The Good Terrorist, where, you know, she's like, okay, people have these sides right now. And she complicates it so much. It actually ends similarly, come to think of it. But I liked the fact that it was kind of a novel of ideas and a thriller, both, and that there was a bad guy who was almost too bad. But yeah.
Yeah, and she, I mean, just to you know, put together with that, she did a really good job, to my mind, of making everybody look like an idiot. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think
that
she
it was
did.
Just like
she
did. Anytime somebody like came up with this like very intricate, brilliant point of view, you'd just be like, oh, grow up.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I liked that about it. And also like that, I mean, I'm thinking particularly about the chapter where they're arguing about feminism and intersectionality and thinking, oh, yeah, I really like seeing this argument and seeing it so well done by two different characters. And, you know, just when I was starting to agree with Tony, I'd think, oh, yeah, Amber, you're right. And that was like, it was like a Lessing novel. Yeah.
Negative capability.
Negative capability.
Yeah.
Jen Bingham.
I also liked the character studies that were brought up in the book. Not brought up in the book. I felt like we got really close to the characters as they described themselves so much that they didn't really actually always know what was happening because they were viewing reality through their own lens. Like I noticed Shelley would talk about what a great person she was. It was interesting. And then do something really horrible. And obviously all the characters were pretty complex. I do agree the villain was a little too bad, but he was an enjoyable bad villain.
Yeah, he was an enjoyable bad villain.
He was, but boy, he was just like the worst villain in the history of villains, I think.
I mean, he would come right out and say, oh, yeah, well, six people died in that, you know, avalanche. But, you know, it's going to be better for the whole world, actually, once I have my billions.
When you say worst villain, do you mean worst in, how do you mean worst? Like he was just evil?
Yeah, he was just evil at every turn.
Yeah, I felt differently about him. I mean, this is one of those things that I'm hesitant to talk about. I thought, like, dude, couldn't you have outsourced some of this evil? I mean, he seemed involved in a lot of stuff that, like, a billionaire shouldn't be involved
in. Well, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, oh, I'm going to fly in there and kill some people. And it's like, no. Stay in the United States. You know what I mean? Pull the trigger from, you know, the other continent, you know? I mean, he seemed silly in a way.
Well, right? Yeah. I mean, I think that's it. To me, he was cartoonishly evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe, you know, having read about the visit to the Titanic with those billionaires, you could say, well, there's an argument. These guys do stupid things and go, you know, because at times you just think, well, how did you end up there? Why don't you leave?
I feel like there were a lot of, like, writerly red herrings in this. Like, when you got to the end of that section, I feel like I could almost feel this brilliant writer who's got this, you know, tremendous capacity for getting inside people's heads and tremendous capacity for sentence making. Some of the best sentences I've ever read, some of the most intricate sentences mm-hmm. I've ever read. And she gets to this point and goes, oh, I can't sustain this. What am I going to do? Oh, somebody has to kill somebody. And it seemed almost like glib to me that Owen would die. You know what I mean? It just seemed like a narrative necessity in order to get the... And from that point on in the novel, and I could see that she had to do it, that the author had to do it. But from that point on in the novel, things became a little bit incredible to me.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
When I was reading the book the first time, you know, I was like, this is so good. I've got to tell everybody about it. It's so good. I liked it. It has similarities to Richard Powers' The Overstory. I mean, and it's dealing with. But when it got to the end, I just wanted to throw it across the room. Like, why did you do this? It's like the first thing I remember a creative writing teacher saying to me is that there will be no axe murders in any story in this class, which, of course, everybody wanted to go then write about axe murders, but just too easy. And I thought, yeah, this is crazy. I'm not ready for this to end, and I'm not ready for it to end in this way. The second time through, I kind of...
You read it twice?
Yeah. Oh my God. Well, that's because I forgot.
Okay.
I forgot it. I read it like when it first came out, and I mean, I pre-ordered it and everything. Second time through, I was like, okay, I'm not so disappointed, because I was very disappointed when I read it the first time. But then I got why.
I mean, it was
she did it. Why she? Had to
yeah,
do
I mean, it was
it.
A good.
It
was
smart.
You know, it was a good book, and it held together. And I don't want to criticize her too much, because, you know, you do what you have to do to keep this monster together. But it annoyed me that Owen's death was an accident. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There was plenty of evil people around. Somebody could have killed him for non-accidental reasons. And that instead of just dealing with the problem, what is his name? David? No, Robert. Robert LeMoyne just overcomplicated everything. Do you know what I mean?
He did, but that's because he was a cartoon evil genius.
Yeah.
Right, but like if you really want to get into it, another thing that I want to talk about is that his idea for stealing these natural resources. I mean, I hate to say it, guys, but you just go to the, you know, Prime Minister of New Zealand and say, hey, there's a bunch of natural resources. Can I just mine those? And they'd be like, okay, sure.
They'd want a cut, though, probably.
Yeah.
I don't think he wants to share it with anybody.
He might not be the wealthiest person in the history of the world.
Yeah.
And I think she tried to cover that by anticipating that objection and saying that they were not allowed to mine in national park land.
Because that never gets in the way.
Yeah, no, that never. And then the other thing about Owen's being an accident, there were these hints, and they may have been red herrings too, that Robert Lemoyne had actually, you know, changed the code on the gate and done everything that day because he actually knew Owen would be coming. And then, you know, I don't know, but that's way too complicated. That's way too complicated. And then, it's like a bad defense lawyer or something.
Okay, can I say one more quibble and then I won't? Then I'll stop quibbling. I'll be supportive. Is Tony? Tony upset me too. Because Tony's such a, and then he just goes out into the wilderness, and it turns out that like he's like a superhero. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like because I kept going, how do you know all this? And you can't make a living, you know what I mean? Or you can't get your articles published in reasonable publications, but you go out and you understand, you know what I mean? And then every once in a while she would throw in some detail like he didn't know how to do this. And it's like, that's kind of random. Why does he not know how to do this when he knows how to do everything else?
I think those are all reasonable questions. Yeah, I think
those are all really reasonable questions.
Well, kind of staying there for a minute. Let's just talk about the characters for a minute. There are, five or six viewpoint characters in the book, both of the Darvishes, Mira, Shelley, Tony, Lemoyne.
I think that might be it.
Tony's the girl he saw also.
Oh, right.
I forget her name.
Ruby? Yeah.
Bridget? No.
Ruby?
I don't remember.
I don't remember.
But there were a lot. Do we have a strong feeling about who the protagonist was?
Oh.
Does it matter? Did you empathize with any character more than the others?
I found most of them dislikable to a degree, but I grew to like Mira and Tony, even though they were kind of annoying people. Mira, I think because she was always trying to do the right thing. So I appreciated that in her.
Yeah, there was a sweetness about Mira. Yeah. But I didn't really get her. I mean, I wanted to know what she was about, you know?
She was a little mysterious.
Which one had the mother who was a hippie? That was Mira.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the book starts with a lot of kind of backstory about the two women's relationships with their family and their mothers. And so that kind of sets you up to think that Mira's the protagonist, and she's the one with kind of, she thinks, the most agency. I Shelley at times I thought, yeah, Shelley, get out of there. You're the right, you know, you should be doing that. But Shelley wasn't that complicated.
Yeah, Shelley just slept with Robert.
Right.
He just said, you want to sleep with me? And she said, okay.
And that was part of Robert's evil plan, you know,
right.
Like to lead Mira on. And Shelley was kind of up for that from the very beginning because she was going to take Tony.
Yeah, that was her whole plan.
Yeah, that was her plan from the beginning. So, and I did, toward the end, I was rooting for Tony. I really was. I know he was like cartoony.
You can't underestimate how unlikable he was before, right?
Yeah.
I thought he was just ridiculous.
You did, really?
I mean, because he was just one of those guys that's like, I have a guy like that in my life right now, a communist where it's just like, anything you say, he can tell you how you're wrong.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so like at the end of the day, it's just like, shut up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Go get a job. You know what I mean? But
I felt like he was young and had ideals and he would have all that beaten out of him had he lived to get a job.
Well, yeah, he was like trying to get a job, but he was just trying to be a star mostly.
Yeah.
And he was canceled. That was, I think, a large part of his anger at the meeting, you know, why he was going on and on about intersectionality and identity and, you know, how that separates people or something. And then he also had money, which nobody knew about. So, yeah, I don't know. I just see this writer putting all these little details in, thinking, oh, somebody's going to argue, blah, blah, blah. And so I'm going to put one little detail in to anticipate that objection and refute it. So if Tony goes crazy at the meeting, it's because he feels like he lost his big chance at writing because he felt canceled. So I don't know. Yeah, I felt he was young. He was young, and he was trying to do the right thing by exposing this mining and taking pictures of it and sending the pictures to his mom.
Right. Well, I also thought it was interesting that he was so convinced that the government was involved.
Yeah. I know.
That if he hadn't thought, if he just hadn't gone there and had just called the police at any time, you know, the whole thing could have been wrapped up easily.
That's such a good point. Yeah.
When, so how long was it between the, this novel and her last novel? A decade?
10 years, yeah.
10 years.
That's interesting because it's, yeah, I don't know if I can make anything out of that, but I, he was, it's interesting.
I did like how she explained a man in the middle attack so deftly in like 3 sentences. It was very good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And maybe like I can atone for my quibbles. I mean, I have a couple of things to say.
My, no, your quibbles are right on.
Well, but you know, it's funny. Like, two things I want to say. One is that she's, some of those sentences should just be in museums. I mean, she was just, she writes sentences, particularly in the first half of the book, where, oh my God, that's the most precise description of that thing that I've ever heard in my life, right?
Right.
And I can completely track what you're saying, and it's been going on for like 150 words, and I can, like she, and it's almost like if she was my friend, I would like put my hand on her shoulder and I'd say, listen, calm down with the complicated sentences. Like, let's, maybe we're going to cut some of those. You're really good at this, and I want you to restrain yourself a little bit, because it got to be a shtick after a while, right? You know, there were a lot of things that I just felt like didn't need to be explained. Do you know what I mean? Or particularly physical things, like she would say, you know, Robert was up the hill and we couldn't quite see, they couldn't quite see him because it was blocked by, and I was like, okay, I have perfect confidence that that will all works out. You went up the hill, you figured all this out. I don't need that, any of that. I just need to know that Robert's up on the hill and you're down. You know what I mean? So that's one thing I want to say. Then the other thing I want to say is that if I approach this novel with a kind of tolerance and compassion that I approach a TV show, mm-hmm. it gets a lot better. Because I think that she's just, it's like, you know, like people are always like, oh, Lost didn't end well, or, you know, Battlestar Galactica didn't end well. And I'm like, can you imagine the complexity of that show? Of course it didn't end well. It's, there's no way it could possibly end well. And I think as we talk, I feel that way a little bit about this novel. She's just doing such huge things, and you've got to, like, in some ways accommodate her ambition and say, it's okay. If you needed the murder, Eleanor, that's okay. You take the murder. If you needed things to be a little sloppy at certain points, it's okay. Because you're encompassing the whole world, you know? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does.
Susan, it's interesting. You mentioned the overstory. I actually just finished the overstory. Oh. Like, I read it. I read this a couple of times, and then I read the overstory. But it's interesting, you know, certainly a much, much different act of eco-terrorism going on
right there.
But, I mean, that let's talk about just Burnham Wood, the organization, for a minute. Is what they're doing a good thing? Is it an understandable thing? Is it, I mean, they're stealing. They're stealing resources. Is it terrorism?
I don't think so.
No.
Not at all. I think they're reusing, recycling, all that kind of stuff. They seem like a nice group of kids, honestly. I was a little surprised with how quickly they became seduced by a billionaire, but
I was surprised by that.
Yeah, like almost all of them. But I think they're doing good in the world. I mean, it might technically be illegal, but
they're finding little bits used, and they'll put a plant there,
right.
You know, and harvest tomatoes, and reduce, recycle, reuse.
Yeah.
They're doing it, and they're not really stealing from individuals? They go when they want.
They're stealing water and electricity.
Oh, yeah, electricity. Well,
they steal tools
their stuff
too.
In.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I almost think that's one of those things that I want to forgive the writer for, is that I feel like when she started out, she had a big sense of how transgressive these people were, and that as the book went on, or she realized, oh, they're just good. They're a bunch of good kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you can't imagine somebody coming to me and saying, hey, can we use that unused lot to grow vegetables? And me going, no, you know, they don't seem like they're in the same galaxy as eco-terrorists, you know?
Yeah, no, they don't to me either.
Were they supposed to be eco-terrorists?
No, I wouldn't say, excuse me. No, I wouldn't say I thought they were terrorists, but they were eco-warriors.
They were supposed to have an edge.
Gotcha. Is and that I, how that was presented, like on the cover or
I got
something?
That feeling.
Okay, so I didn't read. I just went straight into this book without right. reading the cover or anything. So I thought it was just a literary novel about a collective of kids at first, and then it turned into
a
thriller.
Yeah, here it says, an undeclared, unregulated, sometimes criminal, sometimes philanthropic, guerrilla gardening collective.
Guerrilla gardening collective. That's
yeah,
right.
Like that. That's good.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but gorilla makes them sound a little bit more edgy than they turn out to
yeah,
be,
no,
though.
Yeah, they're not edgy.
Yeah, they're not very edgy.
But again, with my compassionate attitude towards the book, I feel like she did a lot to, like, oh, I got another quibble.
Okay, okay. I don't want to tear it apart, but I've got one.
Well, yeah, no, like I just, like, you know, I've shouted this at my students to no avail many, many times. Like, what's wrong with chapters and paragraphs? Can we have chapters and paragraphs, please? Because, boy, this thing went, you know what I mean?
Yes.
I started reading it, and I was like, this seems like the kind of book that's going to have 100-page chapters. And I was right.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's like, is that almost like, you know, like in Zen Buddhism, there's this cult of, like, you know, you're not doing it right unless it's painful. You know what I mean? And I feel like, couldn't we just have broken this up a little bit? No. Nobody in the editorial process said, do some chapters for us, Eleanor?
You know what I mean? She won the Booker Prize, so she probably won that argument.
Yeah, she probably did. Yeah. I didn't feel that lack of chapters. And I mean, it just, maybe it's reading it on a Kindle, or I don't know what the difference is. But yeah, that didn't bother me, because I can't see where she would have, like, broken broken things.
I have the answer to that question.
Oh, you do? Okay, yeah. That's great. What is it?
Anywhere.
Oh. But then the question is, why? Why do you need to?
So that a reader who's, like, spends most of his or her time on, you know, a mobile device gets just a sense that this is not going to go on for 20 hours at a clip.
Well, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Got it.
Just like, I mean, I just look to those endings of those chapters to say, there's a break there. I can stop at some point.
Right. And, and I'm more of the kind of reader, it's like, I don't want to break. I want to just stay lost in this world as long as I can. And that's one of the reasons I didn't like the ending bothered me, because it's like, wait, you've brought up all these things and I want to keep following them and thinking about these ideas. And, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, it didn't bother me in this book, and I like my chapters, but mm-hmm. for some reason this one didn't bother me.
Yeah, didn't bother me at all.
So Susan, let's talk about some of those ideas. You know, one thing the book brings up is the idea that the super wealthy are able to affect the world in more ways than anyone in the history of the world, even if they're not the wealthiest person in the world. Should we just all hope they're going to do the right thing? Is that, are we anti-billionaire?
That's such a good question. I guess I am.
Me too.
I guess I would be more pro-Tony in this case. I just, you know, I don't feel like he even knows it. Robert Moyne, the evil billionaire says, yeah, we know we've got more power than anybody in the world has ever had power before. And unfortunately, it clearly corrupts. That was one of the things I loved about the Burnham Wood Collective, because in a lot of books about collectives like that, one person gets power hungry and it becomes a cult, or, and this just doesn't. And so when, you know, Mira may be doing a disservice to Shelley when she says, well, okay, we've got this money now from the billionaire, we're going to move the collective into a better economic, you know, place, she basically, you know, gives up her leadership to someone else. And so I liked that. And Robert Lemoyne knew he was a horrible person.
He did know he was a horrible person.
Yeah. But he also thought, well, you know, I'm helping the whole West, because once we get these minerals out, then, you know, everybody has their cell phones and they're going to love me because we no longer have to get those rare minerals from China or someplace in the East. So he was telling himself he had kind of a thing to do, but it was mostly going to make him richer.
Yeah.
And he was a doomsday prepper, too. Like, you know,
but
he's going to be under. Yeah, it was fake. Once he got it out, he was really going to do it.
I mean, it'd be a nice thing to have.
Oh, an underground bunker.
Sure.
Yeah. Yep.
So, Jen, is this, I mean, you thought it was going to be a literary novel. It sort of became a thriller.
Yep.
Is there anything larger we're supposed to take away from it there about the environment or late stage capitalism or the surveillance state or anything else?
I think so. Yeah. She's obviously someone who's interested in the environment and pro that and against billionaires. But it's kind of all there, you know, on the page that the way we live isn't really right, that young people have good ideas about how to share the earth better sometimes, and that billionaires are bad and stealing stuff, basically. Did anybody think he killed his wife or not?
Oh, that seemed like a pretty open question.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think thought he did. I actually thought he killed Owen, too.
Oh, really?
But I don't know. I think he was, it didn't matter to him. I don't know.
Who was Shelley thought that he killed his wife, or was it Mira? Somebody figured out that he'd killed his wife. Who was
that? I think
that?
It was like a chatter in the press, even. I think it was just like in the air that people thought he killed his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Like comments on articles.
You know, like all these characters. And again, I want to approach this with compassion. All of these characters seemed a little bit muddy to me. Like, I don't, you know, like you guys seem really convinced of Robert's evil, but I don't even know if I have a handle on him as a character enough to say that he was evil. Sometimes I think about the book and I think he's just a guy. He's just a businessman. He's just trying to get along. You know what I mean? All these things that happened, you know, I mean, like covering up the death of Owen doesn't seem extraordinarily evil. It seems like a good business practice.
That seems like less evil than just like hacking into everyone's phone and doing all of that stuff.
And killing people and
causing an earthquake that kills a lot of people. So that,
right.
Plus, yeah. Like destroying a beautiful national park.
Right. But all these things that you guys just said are just sort of standard business practices in the world. They're not.
That's exactly Tony's point.
Right.
It's like those are standard business practices. We want our cell phones to work with rare minerals. I mean, there's and so we're all complicit. And at the very last line in the book is, you know, Tony is setting all the camouflage on fire so that people can see the destruction of the park and the destruction, you know, of the land. And says he hopes somebody can get the fire out or can, you know, see it. See what's wrong there. And in a way, I think that's what this book was trying to do. Can we see the fire and can we put it out?
I think you're right. And I think, but my question is, are we talking about the environment or are we talking about capitalism? Or
yes.
Both? I think we're talking about capitalism.
I think it's a book about economics. It's about capitalism.
Yeah.
And they're arguing different sides and trying to, you know, Burnham Wood gets involved in it and, you know, how that destroys them as well. And, yeah, I think that that's the question. And she doesn't give any simple answers because it's fiction. She just has people involved in something evil. Not saying that capitalism is evil. I don't know enough about economics to say any of that. But in this book, it clearly they're looking for some alternative. And I'm not sure that they can find it because things are just stacked against them.
Well, but they also compromised themselves.
Right.
You know, things are stacked against them, but they also threw in with the evildoer. I mean, I will defend the ending on that basis. I will defend the ending on the basis of we're all screwed. I mean, and that's that's what the message is.
Yeah. And again, that Tony says that at the meeting. It's like, he completely says that we're all. Oh, I wish I could find it.
I don't know. I mean, I sort of want to say everyone in this book is childish. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I'd like to see somebody that, like, you know, like, is there one character that gets up in the morning and, you know, goes into a government office and tries to compromise, you know, with people to get a better deal for the environment? Is there one, you know, is there one person that's like, you know, a billionaire who's maybe just a little more thoughtful about being, well, forget about that one for a moment, because the billionaire thing is just a problem in and of itself. But, you know, like, I wouldn't be hanging around with these bozos. You know, I mean, it wouldn't be like, oh, we're going to put that's really cool, those gardens everywhere and stuff like that. I really like that. And then I would go home. You know what I mean? I wouldn't, they seem sort of.
Their cult is not your cult.
They're hobbyists. You know what I mean? They don't seem to me well, let me put it this way. I wanted to say that they don't seem to me like serious people, but I think they're serious people, but they don't seem to me like the kind of serious people that they think they are.
Yeah, I think you're right, Dan. Excuse me. But they're also now in this place where they're saying, maybe we can become a legitimate organization.
Yeah.
Right? You know, maybe now with the backing of this horrible billionaire, who maybe isn't so horrible because he's going to support us, you know, we can actually become something and really have an impact.
Change the world.
Right. Yeah. Right. Become more than the little guerrilla gardening organization. But that is, you know, that's just another seduction.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of compromising. That's a lot of compromising.
It is a lot of compromising. I think Shelley was approaching adulthood, although her reaction to how to deal with humans was terrible. But she had those business plans. She had all these ideas. She organized everything. She was clearly a type A personality, but who couldn't communicate with her friend. Like, she really loved Mira, yet she was going to sleep with her ex-boyfriend to get away from her because she couldn't say, I don't want to be here anymore. Mm-hmm. So she's childish in that respect for sure.
So, Dan, you said a couple times you think that Lemoyne killed Owen. Do you think Susan, you think he...
Yeah.
What do we think of the whole... So you think he brought the acid to the party for the purpose of someone stealing the van and killing Owen?
That's one of the things she implies, I think. I don't really believe it, but, you know, because Shelley doesn't know if she actually ran into him or not, because she was on acid. And so I don't know. I mean, and I don't know. Is it important? What would you say to a student who left it that vague, who wanted you to maybe assume that he had done that, or just say it's not important? I don't know what I'd do either.
The more that we talk about them, the more that these characters seem to me, again, not unlike a TV show, that seem to me that they're prey to the needs of the plot. You know what I mean? That it's like something needs to happen, and so like suddenly the character has a slightly different motivation. Like, I mean, the biggest thing about Robert is that he's a freaking billionaire. As far as I understand the world, that kind of money can make anything happen, and you don't have to be there. You know what I mean? Like, if he needs Owen out of the way, you know, throw $20 million at the guy, get him out of the way. Why do you need to kill him? You know, I mean, especially in the second part of the book, there's a lot of zigzagging that Myra and Shelley do that seems illegitimate to their characters. Like, why is it so easy for Robert to convince them to sleep with him? You know what I mean? Like, what's that about? You know what I mean? I don't understand it.
He seemed like he was a good looking dude with $1 billion.
With $1 billion and Shelley, I don't know that Myra ever slept with him.
She thought she was ready to.
But with Shelley, I think it was she was just really, you know, still angry with Myra at that point for a number of reasons. And so I think she was kind of getting back at her.
There's a lot of weirdness that I think has to do with the narrative. And one of the weirdnesses is that, okay, so they won't sleep with, you know, Robert. How come there's nobody else that they're sleeping with? What's the point of having an eco-terrorist collective if they're not sleeping with each other?
That's a good point.
You know, and then this is like the coup de grace for everything that goes on in the book. Nobody has any fucking children.
Good point.
In the whole book has children. It's like, and again, it's the kind of thing that, like, I don't know how young she is, but like a young writer will do. Like, you know, I don't have children. I'm nobody, you know, and it would, like, you know, if I were at one of those meetings, and Tony was doing, you know, that thing, you know, what his Tony's thing, I'd be like, off. I gotta send my kid to college. You know what I mean? Don't talk to me this way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think in that discussion they were talking about, you know, one of them said, this is not a philosophy class here. You know, we're talking about practicalities. And, you know, one of them did say, I need to get home. I got to get up to go to work, you know, things like that. So I think they sort of did, you know, the issue of what you do with the practicalities when you're trying to change a system comes up. But it's really interesting that all the rest of the characters in Burnham Wood were basically, I don't know, like the Seven Dwarves or something. Yeah. Like, you could have given them names like Sleepy and Dopey and Happy, and they just did their thing, except for Amber, who has the one moment of
being annoying
and arguing. And
see, these are kind of all my greatest fears about, like, I probably wouldn't have sought out this novel on my own.
Right. You know,
because it's all my greatest fears about a novel of ideas is that it's not going to have any people in it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, but, yeah.
To circle back to the people sleeping with Robert thing, I felt like he was a psychopath and had that charm that psychopaths have. So, in addition to being a billionaire, he probably was... He was also on the page, very charming, just kind of weaseling his way in. But I very much agree with the statement that they should all be sleeping together. That's insane that they're not. They should all have, like, weird histories together. And
the only one we have is the weird history with Myra and
Tony.
Yeah. and Shelley, I guess, a little bit. But
yeah, very good point, Dan.
Yeah, what's going on with the world that Myra and Tony only slept together once? You know what I mean? That too, you know what
and
I mean?
And
then didn't talk for a long time.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense at all.
Again, you know, it's like, again, I think I'm onto something with this, like, comparison to TV shows. It's like Eleanor Catton is moving these people around and making a lot of questionable choices about characterization, but she's doing it for our pleasure. You know what I mean? Like when you watch a TV show and you go, oh, well, that would never happen. And then you just go, that's okay. You know what I mean? It's like, we're moving through the story. It's for my pleasure that, you know, idiotic transition was there. And I feel like there's a lot of genuine pleasure in this book that's made possible by the fact that she's like moving people around in ways that don't make sense. Like, you know, like at some point, you know, there's in Eleanor's computer, there's 100 pages about them, all the people sleeping together. And it just became clear at a certain point that that was a distraction and that it had to be cut, you know?
Because the ideas were so important.
Right.
Which is the way I feel about Doris Lessing, too.
Yeah.
I mean, these characters, it's all, you know, dealing with. And this is maybe a silly question, but you watch Succession, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so is there any, how does this billionaire compare to, that's a TV version of
I will say
wealthy
this,
people.
The first portrait I saw of Lemoyne in here, I thought was Kendall Roy. Yeah. I saw Kendall Roy come walking out of that airplane.
Yeah.
Well, you know, but I mean, Succession's a good example. I mean, I don't think Logan Roy ever does anything that's inconsistent with his self-interest. I mean, And I think that makes him a stronger character than Lemoyne. But also, you know, I mean, I don't see Succession as like a, you know, a thoughtful and complicated discussion of capitalism. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think of it
mm-hmm.
as just like, wow, this is a crazy family. I love these people, you know. But, you know, I don't think it's. It's as thoughtful as this book in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like Logan. I mean, like. I mean, we can talk about Succession sometimes, but it's like those people are all idiots, and they behave like idiots. You know what I mean? And this book seems to be proposing that these people aren't idiots, that they know what they're talking about.
But if you go to Logan's, you know, ultimate put down, you are not serious people.
I was thinking the same thing.
They do not seem like serious people, except for Lemoyne, probably.
Yeah.
No one else seemed like a serious person.
And in this particular world, the only real argument you can make is that, like the commercial about, we are at Fisher Investments, we are fiduciary. And you think, oh yeah, that's a really good thing to be. You're looking out for my best interest, but in the world of this book, it probably would not. Right. Because there are moral questions too and ethical questions, and and Logan lives in the world where, it's all about maximizing profit for everyone, the investors, for yourself, et cetera, et cetera. And if there's a problem with the environment, well, you try to figure out how to make it look like you're being a fiduciary in your company by putting up a geodesic dome or something. I don't know.
Well, now I'm interested to know what everyone thinks, if they would recommend this book. Dan?
To a certain kind of person, yeah, I would recommend this book. I mean, I'm glad that I read it, and I didn't have to push myself through it. But at a certain point, when Owen died, I probably would have been like, you know what I mean? I would have been like, I don't want to come off like, well, but when I see the writer pulling the strings, I lose interest in the book. And when, you know, it was like just someone needed to die. And so someone died. I was like, okay, you know? but it was a rewarding and rich experience. And she's a great writer. Yeah.
Yeah. Susan.
I agree. Yeah, I would recommend it with the caveat, you know, just understand that it is kind of a thriller and it becomes that as well. But I loved reading it. I was really interested in it. I was interested in the ideas. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I'm on a Facebook group that completely went ballistically, you know, self-destructive. I won't tell you the name of the group, but it's like a political kind of feminist Facebook group. And it became like one side against the other ideologically. Like, you know, if you're not intersectional, we don't want you here in this group. And I don't know, it became like mean. And I think, yeah, well, I think there's a lot of that in the air. And so I loved watching them talk and trying to work through things and figure, you know, what we should think and, you know, help me understand different things. Anyway, that was an aside. Yes, I would definitely recommend this book.
Yeah, Jen.
I would recommend it also. I liked it quite a bit. And even I like an ending where everybody dies. So I was kind of happy with that. I thought it was good, but with maybe slight reservations that other people, I'm not totally sure other people would like it as much as I did.
Yeah, I probably agree with that. I would recommend it. I think obviously the ending is pretty shocking, I think. And I think it's good to know going into it that you're reading a thriller. But yeah, I also agree with Dan that I just think she did a really nice job. She is a very fine writer, and she did a really nice job of making each one of those characters be an idiot in his or her own way. Yeah, I like that.
Because we are all basically idiots,
right? And we all
know it.
We all deserve what's coming to us. All right. Well, speaking of things we got coming, anybody have a book recommendation? Jen, what do you got?
I read Big Swiss recently, which is a book about. She transcribes the sessions with a therapist and becomes obsessed with one of his clients and ends up meeting him and having an affair with this woman. And it's very odd, creepy, good book. I liked it quite a bit.
Awesome. Big Swiss. Mm-hmm. Who's the author?
I can't remember. I can look it up.
All right. We'll let you look it up while Susan makes her recommendation or several.
Several. I just finished reading Demon Copperfield. Copperhead, sorry. Yeah, my phone corrected it. And I thought it was pretty great. And also Yellowface by R.F. Kuang. Is that how you pronounce your name? And then two more, sorry. Frances Guillot, is that how you pronounce her name?
I don't know.
She was the one woman who left Picasso. And she just died recently. And so I read her autobiography, My Life with Picasso, and I just really got totally involved in her life with Picasso. It's really interesting. And one more. Larry Lockridge, who's Ross Lockridge's son, just wrote a book called Woman in Green. And it takes place in New Harmony. And then at the end of the book, his father wrote Raintree County. And Ross Lockridge was known for having killed himself after writing this 1,500-page book. And Larry's written about that in different places. But in this book, the characters drop right into the middle of his father's novel from a hot air balloon. And I don't know. It was like a really nice satire.
Yeah,
so
that sounds great.
Bring it up.
I haven't read anything that I want to recommend lately, so I'm going to cheat and say that I know how far I am into it. I'm like 15% into Master of the Senate by Robert Caro, which is about LBJ's years in the Senate.
Yeah.
And it's like that entire 15% doesn't even have LBJ in it. It's just about the Senate and how the Senate's been like such a tremendous obstacle to progress in the United States as it was designed to be, but kind of worked better than they hoped it would work. And so I feel like it's a really well-written book.
Yeah. Those LBJ books are pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So one of my favorite eco-thrillers of the last few years is a science fiction eco-thriller. It's Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry for the Future. It starts with just a horrific and all too plausible climate event that's set in the very near future, and that it's the kind of event that can't help but wake up the world to a climate emergency. And then it goes on to just project like everything it might take, including cryptocurrency and terrorism and science and engineering and the creation of this international team of experts to actually avoid a human-made climate disaster. It was on Obama's reading list a couple years ago, so you don't have to take my word for it. But I liked it too, Kim Stanley Robinson.
And he's hopeful.
He is hopeful.
Yeah, that
the Ministry
hopeful.
For the Future.
Yeah.
Yes,
this
it is.
Book is not hopeful.
Yes.
Burnham Wood is not.
No.
No, it's
it
not.
It is hopeful.
No,
at all. And that's it for us. You can find notes on this and all the shows in the Radio Free Book Club blog on Medium.com. Please consider following us. Drop us a note on Facebook. Stream the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Our show is produced by our friend Oreo Jones for 99.1 WQRTLP in Indianapolis. For Susan Neville, Dan Barden, Jen Bingham, and all the members of Radio Free Book Club, I'm Ken Honeywell. Thanks for listening. And join us next month when we'll look into the lives of two siblings, one in America and one in Ghana, in D.K. Nuro's What Napoleon Could Not Do. Until then, read a book.